Well, thank you very much for that introduction, and good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to start by acknowledging the Aboriginal traditional owners of the place where we meet today and paying respect to their elders and to their culture, the oldest living culture in the world. From that introduction, I guess you can gather that I've had a fairly varied career. If I bring anything to a meeting like this, it's perhaps the value of having been exposed to a variety of different perspectives. Working for farmers and therefore resource industries for 20 years, forging some links between farmers and the environment movement leading to the decade of land care and the land care program, and then also dealing with Aboriginal people through the reconciliation process. I firmly believe that the natural strategic alliance in this country should be between the farm sector, the environment movement, and Aboriginal people, because although they come at it from different directions, deeply ingrained in each group is the desire to care better for country. I should say I've now got a brand new career, that of a handbag. My wife was elected at the last New South Wales election as the first Aboriginal member ever of the oldest parliament in Australia, that of New South Wales. That also has helped me to enrich my perspective of a range of Aboriginal issues. I want to make it clear this afternoon that I can speak only for myself. I haven't got a constituency anymore. I also want to say that I don't think I'm part of any elite, no matter what John Howard and others may have to say. And if I had to define myself, I guess I'd say that I'm really just a pragmatist after working for over 30 years now in the political arena. I've learned, I guess, three very basic things. The first is that in the last analysis, we're all change managers. And the pace of change is accelerating. How we deal with change defines us as a nation and as individuals. Secondly, relationships are absolutely critical in the way in which we go forward because they, in practice, determine the pace of change. And the third thing, of course, is that we need to care a lot better for our country. What I want to do this afternoon is just give you a sort of basic context of where I'm coming from, then talk about some of the issues that are important to me, and then in a very, I hope, pragmatic way, deal with some of the political options that seem to be available at this time. So my context goes something like this. There's no going back from the process of internationalisation. The decisions in the 80s to float the dollar, to reduce industry protection, to break down the centralised wage fixing system are things that we can't move away from. There's no going back. So the issue is really how we manage change, how we take our place in the global market. Secondly, we live, or our society in many ways is defined by our environment. And we need to remember that we live on the lowest, the flattest, and the driest inhabited continent in the world. Australia is 32 times bigger in area than the United Kingdom, but our population is only 20 million. And we've now got 85% of our population living within 50k of the coast. We're a resource-based economy, but we're not using natural resources in a very sustainable way. Our major river systems are stressed. Some agriculture clearly is inappropriate. Soils are becoming more acidic. Salinity is increasing and we're losing biodiversity. In regional Australia, agricultural enterprises have aggregated to achieve economies of scale, and irrigation increasingly is going to shift towards higher value crops as the price of water increases. Partly as a result, we're seeing the closure of small country towns, and they've been replaced by what I call regional service centres, regional cities that provide services on a regional basis. And around these cities are small, mostly non-commercial farms, most of which have got significant off-farm income. So the equation in regional Australia is there's more and more larger farms and there's also more and more smaller farms. And it's the middle-sized family operations which are coming under the most pressure. In my view, one of the critical issues that's around at the moment is a depopulation in relative terms of the inland. And it's an issue which really doesn't seem to be on too many policy radar screens. Now, as that occurs, the Aboriginal population continues to grow faster than the national average and becomes a higher proportion of the population in rural and remote areas. So focus, of course, goes on our relationship with Aboriginal people. And I've got to say, a lot of that's unfinished business. Aboriginal people, of course, remain the most disadvantaged group in our society. And you only have to look at two statistics just to sum that up. Their life expectancy is 20 years less than the rest of us, and twice as many Aboriginal kids still die at childbirth. That's shameful. The national conversation with Indigenous people now is much harder following the abolition of ATSIC. There does need to be some form of national Indigenous representative body to inform debate. So let me turn now to the sorts of issues which are important to me. And perhaps this may define some difference in approach between Robert and me, because I tend to look at issues and how to steer those issues through the political system, rather than defining myself as part of any sort of cultural stream within political parties. Perhaps that's the pragmatist in me. But some of the issues which are important to me are these. The first is how to manage and to nurture the inland. As I said, there's a relative depopulation of the inland going on, and it's not, as far as I can see, on too many policy radar screens. As part of that agenda, we certainly need to use water more efficiently, and I'd argue that there's no place anymore in Australia for flood irrigation. Some farming practices, particularly in marginal country, have to change. Some farmers have got to go and not remain propped up by subsidies for exceptional circumstances. Now, I don't necessarily think it's farmers' fault. In many ways, they've just reacted to market signals. Government wanted to boost, for instance, irrigation production, so over-allocated water. Government in the past has required clearing as the part of grant of various leases. But the equation still is that some of the farming practices now can't be sustained. We need to be creative in the way in which we look for new economies in rural and regional Australia. Some farmers perhaps can be paid for ecosystem services to manage country. Aboriginal people, growing as a proportion of the population, could be contracted to manage their traditional country and to protect its cultural heritage. There may be other possibilities in terms of carbon sinks, carbon trading, as well as ecotourism and cultural tourism. Now, as we undertake that task, or as we look at those issues, we need to understand that we're dealing with social restructure as well as economic adjustment in rural areas. More and more corporate enterprises, regional rather than local communities, an ageing white population shifting to the coast, increasing Aboriginal population. And if we're going to deal with those sorts of issues, then we clearly need to build capacity to manage change within those communities. And I'd still argue that relationships are critical, and in particular the power exercised by various groups in negotiations. Unless there's equity in the power arrangements, then the outcomes are going to be flawed, and in the long term they won't be sustainable. I also think that we need forums to bring different interest groups in regional Australia together, and that local government has got an incredibly important role to play. We also need to understand that the scale of the issues already is enormous. It's likely to be exacerbated by climate change. The costs are going to be high, and they're ongoing. The longer we delay, the higher the cost. I think the only way to deal effectively with these sorts of issues is to develop long-term partnerships between the community and government. But that in turn means we need long-term political commitments and long-term public funding in order to generate necessary confidence. So in practice, you start to talk about a bipartisan political approach from the Coalition and from Labor as the two major party groups. I think that we need to put on the agenda for consideration some form of environment levy in the tax system as a transparent mechanism that would generate predictable revenue. But I also think that if that levy was to be successful, it would need to be administered by some form of independent, call it a sustainability commission, to give public confidence. And of course, the Treasurer seems to have arrived at a similar model with his model for the Future Fund. The next issue that's incredibly important to me is that of unfinished business with Indigenous peoples. And once again, I start from the very pragmatic perspective that whatever you think, whatever the politics, the issues just aren't going to go away. Aboriginal people perceive themselves to be involved in a battle for the survival of their culture, and under their own law, a law which has been acknowledged now in High Court decisions, they can't give up. So they won't give up. Now, there's always going to be two parts to the Indigenous agenda: social justice and rights as First Peoples to protect their culture. So what needs to be very clearly understood is that the practical reconciliation agenda won't succeed unless it can operate effectively in Indigenous culture. The two agendas have to be accommodated. Perhaps the sharp end of this debate at the moment is that past approaches to service delivery just haven't worked. As I've already pointed out, the current levels of Indigenous disadvantage are absolutely shameful. And this was acknowledged at the Reconciliation Workshop in Canberra last week by Peter Shergold, Dr. Peter Shergold, the Secretary of Prime Minister and Cabinet's Department. He said very clearly, past program delivery mechanisms haven't worked and we don't know what to do. That's just about a direct quote. The Prime Minister, I think, has also tried to come to grips with that issue. He said last week, of course, that the agenda now must include rights as well as responsibilities. That's a big step forward in language, but it remains to be tested in practice. To me, the bottom line is that effective service delivery in turn requires effective Indigenous governance structures. And they're only going to be effective, those governance structures are only going to be effective where they take their legitimacy from cultural authority. So once again, there needs to be an intermeshing of a rights agenda and a practical reconciliation agenda. And I make the point again, the way forward is more difficult now because there's no national Indigenous representative body to inform, debate and consider proposals. So the agenda that was outlined last week at the Reconciliation Workshop was for a 2-year conversation in the lead up to a Reconciliation Convention in 2007. And that conversation is likely to include the need for a Bill of Rights and changes in the Constitution to recognise Indigenous rights, as well as a discussion about how Indigenous people can develop their own economic base, take their place in what Noel Pearson refers to as the real economy. Now, I note from the weekend's press that the Lingiari Policy Centre is to be formed with a distinguished Aboriginal board that includes Patrick Dodson and Noel Pearson. Its vision, and I quote, is for Aboriginal children to have the same expectations of life as their fellow Australians, to develop their unique cultural, social and economic capital, secured by a new framework for Aboriginal rights and responsibilities, unquote. That policy centre no doubt will play a significant role in informing the national conversation over the next 2 years. Now, I acknowledge that there are, of course, many other important issues. Everyone's got their own perspective. But the point I'd make is that most, in my experience, require a long-term vision and a coordinated strategy to move forward. And here's where it gets hard for me, because I really feel like I'm starting to turn into a grumpy old man. Issues that are important to me require long-term vision, long-term funding, and a whole of government partnership with the community. And it's the same, as I said, for many other issues. But that's very hard for our current political structures to deliver. Any government, whether it's Labor or Coalition, prefers not to give commitments beyond the current term of government. And it's extremely difficult to create common bureaucratic cultures, particularly between the Commonwealth and the state. Most issues, therefore, in practice, have a 3 or 4 year horizon until the next election. And as I said, part of the answer, to me, has to be bipartisan approaches by the major political parties. And we did achieve that with the decade of land care, which was supported by all of the parties in the parliament. But bipartisanship is very hard to construct. Political parties need to generate choices for the electorate, so a cooperative approach certainly isn't natural behaviour for them. They have to be pushed into it. Political parties also appear to accept that they're constrained in the choices that they can offer by the need to reflect the views of the majority of voters, particularly in marginal seats. So my observation today is that parties seem to follow public opinion rather than lead. They work on the basis that the primary goal is to win power and to hold onto it, the Graham Richardson whatever it takes attitude, reflected on the Conservative side by the Coalition's multi-billion dollar spending spree before the last election, and of course many other political tactics. So my problem is that my issues need far-sighted and effective government, but I don't think I'm getting it. And I'm getting grumpier and grumpier. So what are my options? Well, I mean, the Howard government has disappointed me. Dissembling on Tampa, the war in Iraq, operation of detention centres, refusal to apologise to the stolen generations, reductions in social safety nets and so on. It's a government that lacks compassion. But Labor has also got its problems. It's been preoccupied with leadership issues and the need to balance its factions. It's run by the factions. It doesn't seem anxious to do the hard yards on policy development and community networking. The small target syndrome, at least if you leave out the last election, seems to have prevailed. And Labor today, at least to me, doesn't instantly generate great confidence. The Democrats have self-destructed and the Greens don't have any economic credibility. So what do? Do you start another political party? Well, that's a very big ask. You've got to sign up members, you've got to develop policy across a broad range of issues, you've got to run a secretariat, you've got to select candidates, you've got to manage postal votes, pre-poll votes, booths at election time, you've got to run advertising and promotion, you've got to fund travel, and the way that public funding requirements are today, they favour the established parties. Public funds are paid according to the votes at the previous election. So if you're a new starter, absolutely, number one rule, you're going to have a very big kitty, at least initially, and very big and deep pockets, at least for the first 3 or 4 years. Hard task. So what do I do? What can I do? The sort of, I guess, answer that I've arrived at myself is that I've got to think national, sure, but I've also got to act local. I'm not going to rely on some grand master plan that's developed by someone else and put in place by someone else. As an individual, I accept that I've got some personal responsibility to progress the issues that are important to me. That's what I've been doing for the last 10 years. There are all sorts of individual actions that can be taken in the workplace and the neighbourhood. So it's not always just a flick pass to someone else. It was a classic example at the reconciliation workshop last week. One of the big mining companies got up and said, "We've stopped racism." And I said, "What?" He said, "We've stopped racism." And what they do is that their position on racism is part of the induction for all of their employees. It's made very clear that racism will not be tolerated. It's unacceptable. And if there are racist remarks or racist action, no second chance, out of here, Charlie, on your bike. And the mining company says that those sort of institutional arrangements are changing behaviour. They may not change attitudes, but they're changing behaviour in the workplace. And that's what you can do. You know, there are actions that can be taken by companies to combat racism, to introduce employment targets, to review their production methods so that they're more sustainable. There's a lot also that individuals can do in their own neighbourhood. So that's one part of my answer. But second, I plan to use my political power, whatever it is, hopefully more effectively. I can get involved in the party of my choice, and I can seek to influence its policies. But if I don't think the major parties are capable of being saved, then I can support an independent candidate. And more independents are now being elected to state and federal parliament, particularly former mayors with a long history in local government. They've earned their community support in local government and command large personal followings. So I just make the very basic point to you that if enough independents are elected, they can have the same impact as a formal party. As a group, they could exercise balance of power in every parliament in the land. And perhaps then that becomes the most effective scenario. keep on electing independents until the major parties are forced to deal with the issues that come direct from the community rather than through the filter of the party machine. And in so doing, maybe what you do is create a virtual community first party, one that takes its legitimacy from local communities, not deals between factional groupings, one that has no formal structure, but comes together as a voting block of independents in the parliament when there's sufficient mutual interest. Perhaps that's one way communities can take greater control. Thank you.
Well, Rick, just on the grumpy old men issue, I actually had some woman ring me up the other day and said she was doing. She said she was doing a program on grumpy old women, and would I like to be part of it? Now I said thanks, but no thanks. But I'm sure she'd broaden it out and accommodate you. Can I go back to the to what you were saying about land and getting farmers off land? Over the last few years, I've spent some time in Western New South Wales, and there is a feeling among some people there, although certainly not majority feeling, that areas like that should really go into one extended national park. I wonder what you think of that, and what you think also of the alternative argument by John Howard a week or so ago that we really must keep up a critical mass of farmers in some of these areas, and John Anderson's point that if you don't, then you create a whole new set of problems.
I don't necessarily see any inconsistency between what I've said and, you know, what Howard and Anderson are saying. The only difference I'd put forward is that it doesn't have to be farmers who's, or you don't have to be a farmer or act as a farmer to stay, to do what it is that's needed. Now, I agree that there need to be people in place to manage country, even if you change the way in which that country is used commercially. So there's no disagreement on that point. We can't have a depopulation of the inland. Even if people, you know, leave tomorrow, the inland is not going to magically restore itself into some, you know, idyllic wilderness. There are things to be done like management of weeds, feral animals, all of that sort of stuff. So getting rid of farmers is not the magic answer. There's still got to be people there to manage country. So the questions, I think, become, you know, what is the most appropriate way to do that? I'm not sure that a national park is. You know, the problem that we've seen in practice with national parks is that lots and lots and lots have been formed, but government doesn't always follow through, or rarely follows through, with the funds necessary to manage them effectively. And that's been the history, particularly in New South Wales and in a lot of other jurisdictions. So I think basically we've got to be a lot more clever about the way in which we manage inland Australia. And as I said in my remarks, I think there are options that deserve much closer consideration. Things like, for instance, paying people as managers of country, paying them for the provision of ecosystem services that may fit into a carbon trading scheme or carbon sinks, ecotourism, cultural tourism, and so on. So the key issue, I think, is to understand what's happening in inland Australia. You know, on the latest census data, once again, as I noted in my remarks, we've got 85% of the population now living within 50k of the coast. And yet Australia still takes, you know, what folklore we've got from the bush. I think that's a point of connection. I think there's a lot more that can be done. But it eventually comes back to money and big licks of money. If we're going to contain further damage, let alone undertake remedial action, then the bill's going to be huge. And it's going to run for, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. So That's where I come in, and so we've got to be realistic about the sorts of mechanisms that we look to achieve that. And I can't go past some form of transparent levy in the tax system, independently administered. You know, one of the big problems with the Natural Heritage Trust and what came out of Landcare was that a lot of the funds tended to be targeted towards marginal electorates. Now, the you know, people won't keep on paying and supporting an environment levy if they see that that's the case.
Now, you mentioned Peter Shergold saying that delivery of Aboriginal programs had failed in the past, and of course now we've moved on to mainstreaming. Do you feel that that has got a better chance of success? And also, what's your view on Noel Pearson's total dismissal of the notion of reviving a separate Aboriginal Affairs Department?
The key to delivery of services is to understand that it will only occur where there are effective Indigenous governance structures in place. And that means people have to understand the need to embed those governance structures within Indigenous culture. I mean, it's facile when you say it like this, but, you know, at the end of 15, 20 years involvement with Aboriginal people, the most important realisation I've come to is that when you're dealing with Indigenous people, you're dealing with a different culture. You know, it is just a completely different culture. And perhaps the hardest thing for non-Aboriginal Australia is to accept and recognise something that we're never going to understand. You know, that's a big cultural jump for a lot of people to make. So, you know, if we're going to have effective delivery, it'll be horses for courses, and it will depend on the culture of individual Aboriginal or Indigenous nations. So I just come at it from that point of view. And the, you know, it's about time we got out there and we did a very simple thing. You know, instead of going in with preconceived models, but to actually sit down and ask Aboriginal people, how is it that you want to do business with us? Not tell them how we're going to do business with them. You know, it's just a fundamental mind shift. Now, as far as the separate Aboriginal Affairs Department, you know, I don't necessarily, you know, I haven't seen the full text of what Noel had to say. I've seen the press reports this morning. But if he said that, you know, he doesn't support a separate Indigenous Affairs portfolio, then I don't agree with him. I mean, at the workshop last week, the symbolism of the Minister for Indigenous Affairs, amongst other things, Amanda Vanstone, having to leave a national reconciliation workshop after 40 minutes to go back and deal with an immigration issue in her portfolio was simply stunning. It was just stunning. And, you know, surely we owe the First Peoples of this nation the respect of distinguishing them from immigration and ethnic affairs. But let me just say one other thing, though. I mean, I don't get hung up on differences of opinion between Aboriginal people. You know, there's another difference of opinion between Loughrinter O'Donoghue and Noel Pearson in today's press. But I well recall what Gullaroy Yunupingu, you know, senior lawman from Northern Australia, former chair of the Northern Land Council, said to me once. He said, when all you white fellas agree on everything, expect all us black fellas to agree on everything. You know, there's 300 separate Aboriginal nations in this country.
You mentioned the need for a representative body. To what extent do you think that ATSIC was the architect of its own demise, or do you think that other forces were much more important than that? And has that really soured both sides of politics to creating another representative body anytime soon?
In some ways, I mean, you've got to place ATSIC in an historical time frame. I mean, from memory, ATSIC was formed in the late 80s, 87, 88, somewhere around there. And I'd argue that that sort of reflected the sort of knowledge base at the time. And, you know, in retrospect, ATSIC was set up to fail. Because under Aboriginal law, no one can talk for anyone else's country. So the prospect of having some single Aboriginal body which can talk for every Aboriginal person is nonsense. We've got to be a lot more creative about the way in which we deal with the need for Aboriginal representation. You know, in an ideal world, there would be representatives of the major Aboriginal nations, and it would be on their nation boundaries, not on our local government boundaries or, you know, other political boundaries. Now, as far as the need for a national representative body, I mean, I just take that as given. I mean, it would be absolutely presumptuous for government departments, for even a body like Reconciliation Australia, which has got a joint Indigenous and non-Indigenous board, to presume to speak for Aboriginal people and to determine policy on behalf of Aboriginal people. I mean, that's their job. Now, as to whether it's been soured, you know, it probably has been soured. I mean, I certainly couldn't support the activities of some people who were elected to ATSIC. But, you know, it's the pragmatist, I guess, in me coming out again. I well remember what a very old and by then quite cynical public servant said to me once. He said, "In Australia, we eventually do the right thing because it's the only thing left to do."
Well, this is the last one, I'm told. We mustn't talk too long. But in general, what's your feeling about Noel Pearson's critique of Aborigines and welfare and what they need to do to improve themselves, to improve their general lot? Do you think this is accurate or do you think it is too harsh?
Well, once again, the first thing to note is that Noel speaks on behalf of his own country, which is Cape York Peninsula. And the issues that he talks about are germane on Cape York Peninsula. The extent to which they're common throughout other areas of Australia where there are significant populations of Aboriginal people, you know, it's up to those Aboriginal people to agree or disagree with Noel. But, you know, I think the central question, I think, in dealing with, or in my experience in dealing with Aboriginal people, because I can really only talk for myself, is how do we protect the oldest living culture in the world and still allow Aboriginal people to take a proper place in a modern society? You know, how do you juggle those two things? And, you know, that's where I think we have to have a conversation. Because the reality is Aboriginal people have legal rights under international law as the first peoples of Australia to protect their own culture. And yet clearly the disadvantage under which they suffer to some extent arises from the fact that they can't take their place in what Noel refers to as the real economy. I mean, you can go through CDP, you can go through a whole lot of training jobs in Aboriginal communities, but the harsh reality at the end of the day is there's no real jobs. So how do you create those real jobs to allow people to take their place in a modern economy? That's the conversation we've got to have. And we've got to listen respectfully to Aboriginal people, not think we have all the answers. And can I say, Michelle, you know, to paraphrase, if that is the last question, I'll take a saying from Aboriginal people and say, "I have survived."